Hey, everybody. Welcome to Therapy Rocks, a personal growth podcast. I'm your host, Signe Darpinian, co-author of No Way and Raising Body Positive Teens, both with Jessica Kingsley Publishers in London. I'm extra excited about the two guests I have today because they are my co-authors, both of No Way, as well as our recent release that we'll be talking about today, Raising Body Positive Teens, A Parent's Guide to Diet-Free Living, Exercise, and Body Image. My first co-author, Wendy Sterling, is a certified eating disorder registered dietitian and approved supervisor through the International Association of Eating Disorders Professionals and a board-certified specialist in sports dietetics in the San Francisco Bay Area. She has consulted for the Oakland Athletics, Golden State Warriors, New York Jets, New York Islanders, and she is also the co-author of How to Nourish Your Child Through an Eating Disorder. She maintains a virtual private practice throughout the U.S. Shelley Agarwal is a physician and board-certified pediatrician, as well as adolescent medicine subspecialist. She treats medically complex teens and young adults and consults on a variety of youth-specific health issues, including adolescent development. Dr. Agarwal has worked with premier academic institutions and continues to be teaching faculty with Stanford Children's Health and UCSF Fresno. She is the medical director of clinics serving justice-involved youth. Wendy and Shelley, thank you for coming to the show.
Thank you for having us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Signe.
Shelley and Wendy, I love having co-authors. I love being a co-author. And I learned that having three different lived experiences and three different scopes of practice means fewer blind spots when writing a book. Shelley, you are board certified in pediatrics and also adolescent medicine. And I know myself that I'm still learning about what it means to be an adolescent medicine doctor. Can you tell us more about what exactly that is?
Absolutely. And firstly, I love being a co-author with the two of you as well. So adolescent and young adult medicine is a subspecialty. Basically, what that means is after you complete your primary residency, which could be in pediatric medicine, in internal medicine, or family practice, you do an additional 3 years of training or fellowship training in this subspecialty that deals with the health needs of teens and young adults. So we work with young people between the ages of 12 and 25 years old. And what's really special about our field, I think, is that we really base our evaluations, our treatments, our engagement with the young person and their family around a developmental model. And so when you think about the adolescent years, it's a very dynamic time, and there's a lot of physical, emotional, social, cognitive, and other change that's happening for this young person. And it's amazing how when you consider some of the changes that are happening during the teen years from this developmental lens, it can really shift your perspective on why certain things are or are not happening and really support the young person and their family.
I've got a question for you. How did you decide to go with adolescent medicine doc specialty?
That's a good question, Signe.
I've never asked you that. I do not know the answer.
So it really was related to how I wanted to apply my interest in advocacy and how it relates to healthcare. I've done a fair amount of international medicine and worked with lots of nonprofit organizations and have a significant interest in gender equity and the needs and care needs of underserved and marginalized populations. And I love the idea of working with adolescents and young adults and being able to partner with them to help them make choices around what they wanted for their own health as they stepped into adulthood, if you will.
And when you talk about learning the or using the adolescent development framework, you talked about different aspects such as physical, emotional, social, and cognitive. Can you give an example of the physical?
Yeah, absolutely. So chronological age doesn't always give you an idea of where someone is developmentally, right? It's a poor correlate at times for developmental stage. So if you think of two young people, biological females who are progressing towards having their periods, there's a range at which periods could start for a young woman. So that could be between the ages of 9 and 13-ish. So you could have one young person who's starting her periods at the age of 11 and another one starting at the age of 13. And that's totally normal. So this is why there's a range in reference to how we develop and grow during our adolescent years, once again, into adulthood. And it's not that there's any one right way. There are, outside of those ranges, times that can be concerning in reference to someone having delayed development. And those are things that need evaluation, or too early development. Once again, that might need evaluation. But it's a range in which someone could progress through their adolescent years.
It makes me think of the exploration we have. We have them in all chapters, but specifically in the puberty chapter, we have this exploration for parents that's subtitled Grow Your Own Way, getting parents to really think about, like, an inquiry, you know, about what were the messages you were given about your body as an adolescent, and thinking about how that messaging and conditioning may affect the way that we think about our child's body in puberty.
Absolutely. And that's really an important piece that we tried to highlight in this book, is basically examining our own beliefs and even biases related to development, and how that also links to our experiences in the past. And basically, we pass on that which we have, right? So if we have these existing ideas about what it means to be quote-unquote normal or quote-unquote healthy, we are either actively or inadvertently offering those to the people around us, specifically the children around us. So it's a really important piece to back up and look at, hey, how do I think about these things? And how am I communicating these beliefs to those around me, particularly my loved ones?
And Wendy, you are a board certified specialist in sports and a certified eating disorder dietitian. And I know you see a lot of athletes with eating disorders in your practice. I've always wondered, what would a session look like for you in real time with an athlete who has an eating disorder? Can you give us some examples?
Sure. Yeah. Well, we know that first, there's lots of eating disorders among athletes. And, you know, it used to be that we thought this just happened in sports like gymnastics or figure skating and wrestling. But, you know, that's not the case. We're seeing this across all sports now. They may come in with something like weight loss or fatigue, dizziness, or, you know, trouble getting through a full practice, soreness. Sometimes they're coming in because they're not making performance gains. So the person to the left, the person to the right, you know, somebody is, they're all progressing, but, you know, you're not. So someone will come in with a complaint, you know, or a concern. And my job is to figure out if this is because of their nutrition, and often it is. And so I'll be looking at, is the diet adequate, balanced, and consistent? There's like a little acronym there, ABC. So, you know, are they eating enough? So are their energy needs being met for what they need and also for their sport? Is their diet balanced? Does it contain enough starch, protein, vegetables, fruits, fats? And then are they doing this consistently? Not just during the weekday, but also on the weekends, and also, you know, throughout the day itself. You know, people may skip meals or may miss a snack here and there. And then what's really fun about this work is that I tie it to their performance. So what are they eating before their practice, during, for practices that are long? And then what are they eating after? Are they hydrating? Are they sleeping? Are they consuming supplements? What's happening with caffeine? How is their energy? You know, all these things, if there's deficits, if there's things missing, it's going to negatively affect their performance, their endurance, recovery, explosiveness. Not to mention, like, they'll be sick a lot. Their immune function will be suppressed. We'll see hormone issues, so irregular menstrual cycle or lower testosterone levels, so reduced strength and things like that. And then, you know, of course, there's also that relationship with food that I am working on. And, you know, we'll come up with a game plan. And that game plan varies based on the person. It might be really small if the person's, you know, not ready. Or it could be something a little bit bigger if they're ready to make more of a change.
For those of you in the audience who might not know, our book is all about taking the morality out of food, no good or bad food. How do you infuse that with the athletes?
Well, we're really making sure that they are including a variety, which is a fundamental principle that I am working on with them from the very beginning. So if it's always chicken, kale, and quinoa, I really want to make sure that there are other foods that they are consuming. And I want to understand why they're so bound to those foods. Sometimes these foods that we consider safe, foods that they feel comfortable with, might keep, maybe it's an eating disorder, maybe it's restricted eating, you know, just may, their eating disorder may really be secretly breathing beneath the surface there. So we want to look at that and examine that. And then we want to really try other things and include other things. As we say in our book, and as I say often in session, even if it's a banana every day, you know, bananas are really high in potassium, but they don't contain vitamin C that an orange has. Chicken every day doesn't have iron that beef would have. So we really want to emphasize lots and lots of variety.
And I like how you say in the book that variety also helps us from getting really bored with our food choices.
Totally. Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
Okay. And Wendy, one of my favorite sayings in the book that you came up with in our exercise chapter is taking the importance of taking the morality out of movement. Why is that so important?
Yeah, this is something that I talk a lot about in session, both with kids, teens, and a lot with parents. You know, there's this morality associated with moving, you know, good if you've exercised, bad if you haven't. And, you know, there's just lots of confusing messages around food and exercise. It's this sort of eat less, burn more. It crops up in pretty intensely around the holidays. And kids are watching and listening what parents are doing. And these kinds of comments get in the way of being able to enjoy food as it is, and really sends the message that people should be worrying about their weight and taking action to do something else. And it gets in the way of our message of what we talk about a lot in our book about this development of friendship with food and body. So, like, for example, if a parent says, you know, we'll get boba after we hike, or I'm going to go to the gym so I can earn my dessert later. And you know, we hear these things all the time. Does that mean that the child can't have dessert later if he didn't go to the gym? Or you know, what happens if the child goes to boba with her friends and didn't hike first? The child may feel guilty and then may have shame about what or how they're eating. You know, they're going to question their body. Like, should they be burning off their food? So, you know, that's what they've been watching in the house. That's what they've been hearing. And so that way of talking, it really creates confusion. You know, what if we just ate dessert that day or got boba with our friends and that had absolutely nothing to do with whether we moved or didn't move that day? I don't think that, you know, parents are meaning to transmit these messages, but, you know, we're living in this weight-centric culture, and if parents are dieting and focused on weight, you know, kids are going to obviously, unfortunately, do the same thing for themselves.
Is making sure that there is not morality associated with movement similar to what you talk about when you use the phrase compensatory movement?
Yeah, it's similar, right? So the compensatory movement is feeling like you need to burn something off or do something in response to your food. And so, right, we want to avoid any kind of compensation in response to our food. Let our food be our food, our movement be our movement. And, you know, when you do things like that, it takes the joy out of movement. You know, if you felt like you had to move because of A, B, and C, well, then all of a sudden movement's a chore. It's just mm-hmm. not fun, right?
Yeah.
We want movement to be fun.
And aren't there studies around if you're moving for internal goals, such as the camaraderie with your teammates or the way that you feel afterwards, that it's more sustainable than if you're exercising for external goals, such as like the shape of our body or aesthetics?
Absolutely. Yeah, totally.
And Shelley, what about morality being attached to weight? Can you talk about this concept and how it seeps into medicine?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a great question, Signa. So, you know, morality is all about something being right and wrong. And there's a lot of ways in which in our society and also in medical culture that we make weight right and wrong. So I'm going to I'm going to give you a story here. But a few years ago, I went to the doctor's office, and I don't remember for what, but I walk in and, you know, the initial piece is they take you over and they do your blood pressure and check your height and your weight. And the medical assistant, who was a perfectly nice lady, basically weighed me and then looked at me and had this look on her face like, oh gosh, you know, you don't look like you weigh that much. And she essentially said something to me to that effect in a way in which she was trying to be reassuring or even as a compliment, like, oh, you don't look as heavy as the scale says you are, right? So, I mean, I'm a doctor. I'm obviously someone who's growing professionally and personally in reference to learning about weight neutral and health at all sizes approaches. And I still stood there and laughed awkwardly and had a moment in my mind where I thought, oh, crap, I weigh too much, right? And so the implication here, which was meant as a compliment, is you don't look as bad as the number on the scale indicates that you should. So take that in a minute. Basically, my personhood, like, was first, like, assessed by a scale and then linked to my appearance. And then basically these two things were taken together and said, I look okay despite my weight. And I got this experience, if you will, as an adult, as a medical professional. Now imagine being an 8-year-old kid, a 15-year-old teenager, a 22-year-old young adult, and trying to basically reconcile that message. It could be fairly damaging and maybe even traumatizing. And there's lots of ways that, unfortunately, in medicine, that we assign this goodness and badness to the number on the scale and use it to basically communicate messages to our patients that are at worst unfortunate and at best unfortunate and at worst fairly damaging. And we haven't even layered on the other things that can impact these perceptions, which are gender, which are ethnicity, which are potential, you know, ideas of poverty or wealth. All of these things layered on top of each other to create these values and these judgments around who someone is based on a number on a scale. So we really have to start challenging society, but also medical culture in reference to these kind of overt and even covert messages about the goodness and badness of weight or the goodness and badness of bodies, and really start deconstructing the morality around weight, because it's very harmful.
Yeah, and like we said earlier in the first question, just, you know, having parents think about the messages they received, right? It's these are messages that we don't forget.
Absolutely.
Wendy, you know my favorite quote in our sleep chapter is, you cannot have a conversation about mental health without sleep having a seat at the table. I know how much you care about your own sleep, your kids' sleep. Can you talk about why this is important in your work with athletes and eating disorders?
Yes, sleep is really foundational. If you are sleep deprived, it's hard to feel great about anything. You can't do well academically, can't do well in sports. You know, without good sleep, it's almost impossible to have a fighting chance to feel good about yourself. Mood suffers, energy, immune system, and body image, which is why, as you know, Cigna, we have this in both of our books. We put it in No Way, and then we also have it in Raising Body Positive Teens, because everything feels worse. I mean, life sucks when you're tired, right? With all of my clients, I ask about sleep and caffeine in every session. Caffeine can disrupt sleep, but it's also a performance enhancer. So a lot of my patients are consuming caffeine. It's really common in adolescents, but it's important to understand how they're using it, when they're using it, how much they're using and consuming it. And so, you know, I don't want it messing up their sleep. And so we try to figure out, like, how we can adjust if that's necessary, just so we can protect their sleep. You know, when looking at sports performance, which is often at the front of my mind, sleep is an underutilized place for athletes to improve. And this stuff is so fascinating. I really love all the research and the information that comes out about sleep and athletes and sports performance. So sleep can improve reaction time, which means literally getting to the ball faster, making the tackle, catching the ball, crossing the finish line first. I mean, that's massive. It's the difference literally between winning and losing. When you're well-rested, there are fewer errors, fewer injuries. I mean, there was a study that showed that teens who got less than 8 hours were almost twice more likely to get injured. I mean, they're all getting less than 8 hours. I mean, no, none of them are getting, you know, I mean, the average amount of sleep that teens are getting is like 6 or 7. Not that that's what they should be getting, but that's just what they are getting. Sleep also consolidates skills into automatic muscle memory. So if you go to practice, have a good night's sleep, sleep can convert the skills you learned into automatic fluid movements, which means you can move, react without thinking. So like, you know, in sports, if you have to think, it's too late. You've missed the catch. You didn't connect with the ball that's coming at your face at 95 miles per hour. But this only happens if you're sleeping enough. So it affects everything.
I love hearing that sleep is a performance enhancer. And one thing that I've noticed in writing the two books and putting this big emphasis on sleep, we've been learning, the three of us have been learning a lot about sleep. And that's an interesting thing. It's not always, sometimes ignorance is bliss, because I recently heard Andy, my daughter, who's 12 years old, she was asking some friends like, oh, let's do a sleepover. Let's get the parents to have a sleepover at like one of our houses, right? And one of the friends, or actually a couple of the friends, are like, yeah, but not your house, Andy. Shelley, at our book launch in the spring of 2020, you said that this book was much more personal for you. And I actually have been thinking about that. That's why I'm asking the question. I'm curious as to why.
So I reflected a lot on my own experiences of weight and body as we were writing this book. And so I'm a first generation immigrant, you know, grew up in a taller, larger body. So these were deeply othering experiences. And they also were linked with, you know, navigating culture, food, body, language. And they fundamentally formed my identity. So as we were creating the content for this book and kind of, you know, framing it around the science and anchoring it in lived experience and cultural context, I had a lot of memories roll in. And some of them were really joyful, and some of them were really painful, and some of them were profoundly formative. So one of those really formative ones is one of my favorite childhood memories. And it was when I was in third grade. So I come from a vegetarian household, and that's for cultural reasons and religious reasons. And so growing up, I didn't have the school lunches that were offered at school because a lot of them were meat dishes. And so my third grade teacher, Mr. Stanley, who will forever be my favorite teacher, I'm going to give you a little bit of background on him first. He was the first person to ever talk to me about anyone of Indian origin in a classroom setting. And so he did this lecture for us, I guess, in which he spoke about Mahatma Gandhi. And he did it specifically, I think, to include me in some content. And then he linked that to Dr. Martin Luther King. And he was the first teacher who talked about like the civil rights movement and introduced our class, or at least me, to this history. And then there was parent-teacher night, and he specifically said, make sure your mom and dad come. And when my mom came in traditional Indian clothes in her sari and, you know, her bindi and her nose ring, he specifically pulled me to the side the following day and let me know how nice she looked. Mm-hmm. This man really saw me. And so how is this linked to the school lunches? So I would play during the lunch hour because, you know, didn't eat the school lunches. So I would be out playing. And my mom tried to pack me school lunch. But because I didn't want the other kids to see my, quote, my Indian food, right, I wouldn't bring it to school. And that's another story for another podcast. But anyways, Mr. Stanley must have seen me playing. And so this one afternoon after lunch, he calls me up to his desk. And I will never forget this moment. I walked up a little scared because I thought, oh my gosh, I've done something wrong. And he never looked up at me during this encounter. He was sitting at his desk and he was writing something with his right hand. And I walked up to his left side and he kept looking down and writing. And as I got to his desk and was standing there, he pushed a Snickers bar towards me. and in a very soft voice said to me, "I know you haven't eaten today." And this man saw this little kid who was different from all the rest, observed that I hadn't eaten lunch, and tried to feed me. And this makes me emotional every time I think about it. The depth and compassion of that moment just basically settled into me, into just my core of who I am, and fundamentally shaped me as a person. And I will never forget it. So, you know, how does that link to this book? Food isn't just something we ingest. You know, it's in many moments at the heart of just the human experience and certainly even human connection. And so when we just reduce it to like component parts, and then when we use words and ideas that make certain foods good and certain foods bad and certain bodies good and certain bodies fat, that or certain bodies wrong, sorry, just for eating a certain way, we just fundamentally do harm to ourselves and others and break these connections that we have with each other. And so, you know, I will forever love Snickers, not because they're like the best candy in the world, but because I will forever love Mr. Stanley and his big heart and his ability to see this immigrant, Indian, tall, fat kid and just respond to her humanity and not exclude her based on her size or her culture. And so this book was very personal in that it has that energy in it for me. And I think it's the reason that it was more of a passion project in reference to breaking some of the stigma around food and body.
I love that story. Wendy, is that your first time hearing that story?
I heard it before, but it's still...
I can't not get choked up.
I know. I feel the same way.
I will also forever love Snickers and Mr. Stanley.
I love Mr. Stanley too.
And I think that by now, the two of you know when I say something, I mean it. We're going to find Mr. Stanley.
I've looked for him and I actually was looking at my old elementary school, Daniel Webster Elementary, if anybody's listening and they know what Mr. Stanley is. No, but I'm actually looking for him myself.
Yes, we are going to get a PI. Wendy and Shelley, I've loved our book writing adventures and I don't want them to be done. Maybe they won't be, but I'm so grateful for the gifts that both of you have brought to the table in writing our books together. And I know I speak for all of us when I say that our hope for raising body positive teens is to give parents and to give caregivers a point of reference for what a friendship with food might look like and a friendship with body. And we are just hopeful that it will find its way into the hands of those who need it. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks so much, Signa. This was wonderful.
Thank you for joining us today for another episode of Therapy Rocks. And a reminder that you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. We'll see you next month.